Hi, I'm Ivan Semenek. Welcome to The Universe in Mind. This week, astrophysicist to the president, we bring you a feature interview with Donald Lamb. Along with colleagues, he figured out how some stars can explode from the outside in. But 2 years ago, he switched off his supercomputer, slapped on a campaign button, and went off to help Barack Obama become president of the United States. So stay with us. It's The Universe in Mind, the show that says, yes, we can mix politics with astronomy. When you meet Donald Lamb, you immediately get the impression of a calm, even-keeled individual. But Donald Lamb seems to be developing a habit for momentous change. As an astrophysicist, his area of expertise includes exploding stars, where rapid and complex changes unfold in the blink of an eye, with dramatic results. Outside of science, Donald Lamb has been witness to a different sort of momentous change. He was an early supporter of Barack Obama's bid for the White House. And during the long campaign, he helped advance Obama's credibility within the scientific community. After the election, Lamb was part of the transition team that shaped the new administration's science and technology agenda. Donald Lamb is a professor of astrophysics at the University of Chicago and director of the Center for Astrophysical Thermonuclear Flashes, better known as the Flash Center. When I met with Lamb last February, it was still just a few weeks into the new Obama administration, and our conversation ranged from the cores of exploding stars to the corridors of power. We met during the annual meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science in Chicago, so you'll occasionally hear some conference noise in the background. Now here's my conversation with Donald Lamb. Donald Lamb, welcome to The Universe in Mind.
Well, thank you. I'm very glad to be here.
Now, I have to say you have one of the coolest sounding job titles in astrophysics, the director of the Flash Center. And I know the universe, of course, is full of big bangs, and I guess you've been studying some of the biggest ones of all. So give us a sense of what your preoccupations are at the Flash Center. What kind of science are you doing there?
Sure. Well, the Flash Center has focuses on astronomical or astrophysical phenomena where nuclear burning is important and where the nuclear burning can run away and lead to flashes and explosions. So it's a pretty exciting field. We have, in the last 5 years, really concentrated on type 1A supernovae. These are stellar explosions that are powered by the release of nuclear energy. And really because these events provide the majority, the lion's share of the iron that's produced and that exists in the universe and many other elements that are important for planet formation and for life. And in addition, it's turned out that they can be used to measure distances in the universe. So we're, as many people know, the way we discovered that dark energy exists.
So let me see if I can remember my astrophysics. A type 1A supernova is what you get when you have a double star system, a massive giant star pouring material onto a white dwarf star that it's orbiting around, and then enough material kind of piles up until there's a big detonation. So that's the type 1A scenario?
It captures it very succinctly. These are white dwarf stars the size of the Earth, the mass of something like the Sun, or 1.5 times the mass of the Sun, in a binary with it. Could be an ordinary main sequence star or one of these giants.
I see.
Okay. And as you said, the white dwarf draws gases and material from the companion star, and those continue to build up on the white dwarf and increase its mass. And eventually, that leads to ignition of flame near the center. And then subsequently, we think that there's actually, it must be, from the observations anyway, two stages. One stage where an ordinary flame is burning for a period of time, and then somehow following that there must be a detonation, and so we call this a delayed detonation model. And it's the detonation really that incinerates the whole white dwarf star, releases enormous amounts of energy, nuclear energy, and causes it to explode.
So what is it that you can learn by studying these events that can aid, you know, our understanding of these bigger questions? What are the issues that remain to be understood about Type 1A supernovae?
That's a great question. Really a key part of the explosion is this ordinary flame burning that goes on. We call this deflagration, so it's the deflagration phase. And the region where burning is happening is very hot, so it's less dense than the rest of the cold star. Mm-hmm. So that region acts just like a hot air balloon. And so it starts rising towards the surface. But in addition, there's cold material in the star above it and hot, less dense material below. And this is the classic case where it will become unstable. We call this Rayleigh-Taylor instability. Up until 2004, it had only been possible to either do two-dimensional simulations of this ordinary flame-burning deflagration phase.
So this is on a computer. With all of the changing pressures and temperatures.
Following, you know, exactly the pressures and temperatures and densities, following, you know, the carbon and oxygen abundances and the burning and what came out of the burning in terms of iron and nickel and so on we were talking about. So some three-dimensional simulations were able to be made, just starting to be at that time, but the codes and the computational resources available to folks made it possible for them only to look at an eighth of the sphere of the whole star.
Hmm.
So the only sensible thing to do when you can only do that is to actually ignite it at exactly the center, even though you're not sure that that's likely. The reason? Because if you ignite it anywhere else, you're essentially saying that you have some kind of eightfold symmetry, you know, that ignited exactly at eight symmetric points throughout the star, and that's just, we know that is not going to happen. So as we're planning our first whole star simulations, we're thinking, you know, why would we start in the flame at the exact center? That's just the most unlikely place in this core. So let's just move it slightly off center and light it there and see what happens. And we were stunned. What happened before was that the ordinary turbulent burning burned a substantial fraction of the star. And then, you know, people thought perhaps somehow that can transition to this detonation, which will incinerate the whole star. What we found is that this little bubble grew and became turbulent, and burning increased, the rate increased. But it was, like I said before, a hot air balloon rising towards the surface and rising faster and faster and faster. And within 1 second, it just popped out and had only burned about 4% of the star. An explosion.
Right. So this is a little bubble of thermonuclear fusion.
Exactly.
That's, you know, as soon as it gets started, basically percolating right out of the white dwarf star.
Yeah.
That is not what I pictured when you started talking about this.
No.
So that doesn't give you a supernova, does it?
Absolutely not. I mean, you need to incinerate to burn the entire star to get the amount of energy that we see and elements that we see as well. So we were like, I would say, thunderstruck. The team involved, Tomek Pleva, the lead, Alan Calder, and myself, could not follow this any further in three dimensions. It was too computationally demanding at that time. So we went ahead and followed it in two dimensions. And as this bubble of burning ash and material broke through the surface, it began to spread across the surface it was no longer confined. So as soon as it popped up, there's nothing to keep it from flowing.
Right.
And so I had this sudden insight that this is going to flow over the surface and collide with itself at the opposite point on the surface in shock waves. And those shock waves are exactly how detonations are triggered on Earth. An example is in the engine of your car. If you hear your car engine pinging, those are little detonations going off in the cylinder of your car engine, which you should take to a mechanic the car and get this not to happen.
Right.
Detonations happen if oil drums, 55-gallon oil drums, are heated in a fire. Eventually, they will detonate. And in all these cases, there's a wall. And what's happening is, as the heat and temperature of either of the fuel in your car or of the oil in this oil drum rise, they become convective and turbulent, and sound waves, very strong sound waves, are being produced by this turbulence that bounce off the walls and come back and meet. And where they meet, the temperature will be even higher, the density will be a little bit higher, and that's where a detonation gets triggered. So the mystery and the puzzle in Type 1A supernova field has been, wait a minute, stars don't have any walls. So how does an ordinary turbulent flame make this critical and necessary, apparently, transition to a detonation
right.
wave, a supersonic wave that will go through the star and incinerate it? Well, here we have what we now call gravitationally confined detonation. Because the surface of the star is finite mm-hmm. and this flow is confined by gravity to the surface, it's bound to collide with itself. And so just like the sound waves moving, bouncing off the containers of this engine of the car, the cylinder, or the drum, oil drum, here the flow is going to run into itself, but at such speeds it will actually produce a shock, and that will cause the star to detonate.
What a picture. So let me see if I can reconstruct this now as we've been talking, because I can picture this bubble where the critical conditions are just right to start this thermonuclear reaction. The bubble rapidly rises towards the surface of the star, can't go any further, so then it starts wrapping around the star, meets on the opposite side, and this meeting of the shockwave triggers a detonation of the entire star?
Absolutely.
So does that mean that a supernova in this case kind of blows up on the outside?
Exactly. This is amazing.
That's a really interesting idea.
So what we could say is that these simulations led us to think outside the sphere.
Right.
It's not a box, but
right.
a sphere. And I think this is, this is really important, how this happened. And what it illustrates, that if you're dealing with very complicated phenomena, where there are multi-scales, different distance or size scales that really matter, and multi-physics, where there's turbulence, and so there's fluid dynamics going on, there's nuclear reactions and burning and combustion going on, shock waves, all these different things, gravity, and they're coupled so non-linearly, as we've just seen. I can definitely tell you, not one of us predicted ahead of starting these simulations, either that the bubble would rise, pop out, and so on, or still less, that the flow would go over the surface of the star and cause the star to detonate. So this is discovery science, and discovery science that can be done, in my best thinking, no other way than by doing these very large-scale, computationally expensive, multi-scale, multi-physics simulations. And those kind of simulations are exactly also what we encounter in trying to deal with climate change, in modeling weather, but even more, equally so, climate,
right.
In modeling hurricanes and try and predict their strength and force and their path and where they're going to hit.
Because so many variables and so much many parameters.
So many scales and so much different physics is going on.
So you've given us a fantastic snapshot of where this field is at right now and the importance of the computer simulations and understanding the Type 1A supernovae and other kinds of complex phenomena, which brings us back to Earth, you know, climate and so on. And I guess in a sense that's true for you. Your career's kind of come back to Earth in the last little while because you've been taking a break to some extent from science in the last year or two, and you've become involved with you were involved last year with the campaign to elect Barack Obama for President of the United States. That's not a typical thing that astrophysicists do. So I want to ask you, first of all, how did this come about? How do you know Barack Obama? And how did you get involved in the campaign?
Well, this is something that was natural. I have had a long-standing interest in politics and in campaigns. I live in Hyde Park in Chicago.
Right.
I got to, you know, get to know Barack. He was for 12 years a faculty member in the law school at the university. His wife, Michelle, was also involved with the university and really began the first program for students and graduate students to go out into the community and make change happen in the south side of Chicago. And I knew her through that.
Were you involved in that program? Or?
What I was asked to do was to evaluate that program a couple times. And it was, and she did a fantastic job, fantastic. The reason that I decided to become involved, I had seen Barack when he was a state senator. And he really made things happen that I never imagined could happen. A couple of examples are there was really a great need to expand the number of children who were receiving health care in the state of Illinois. And there was a considerable opposition to this. And he was able to, you know, meet with all the stakeholders and bring them together, find common ground, and able to find a way forward to where he could persuade everyone to do this.
So his political skills impressed you, clearly, as they did many others. How was it that he came to call on you for scientific advice? Because ultimately you became named as one of, I guess I would say in quotes, one of the science advisors of the campaign. So at what point did he seek you out for scientific advice?
Yes. So I had actually worked in the primary for his Senate campaign a little bit, and then I worked in voter registration for his general election Senate campaign. When he decided to run, I became involved on the ground. And actually, I love being on the ground in campaigns. So I went to Iowa for the last 2 weeks before the caucuses there and worked in Marshall County for the campaign, 20 hours a day.
So what was that like? Were you banging on doors, explaining to people who this guy is?
Absolutely.
Did they know you were an astrophysicist saying this?
Not usually. Mm-hmm. But it was, I think, helpful for me to, if they asked where I was from, I would tell them I'm from Hyde Park in the south side of Chicago. And I want to tell you that Barack Obama is the same person today that he was when I first got to know him 15 years ago. And that his way of trying to move important legislation forward worked in Illinois, and I'm confident that he will be able to make it work on the national stage. So I think that was helpful. How caucuses are won, how primaries are won, how general elections are won is, in my view, the ground game is truly important. Mm-hmm. And what you do do is you talk to people on the telephone, you go to their houses and talk to them in person, and then you do everything necessary to get the supporters to the polls or the caucuses, and that's what it's all about.
So how did science play in to the Obama campaign strategy?
Well, early in 2008, there was a decision to seek policy advice from scientists. And so a science policy committee was organized and stood up with Harold Varmus as the chair, Nobel Prize winner in medicine and president of Sloan Kettering Institute, Cancer Institute, and with me as the convener. Mm-hmm. This was a really wonderful experience of Brock as a community organizer and what he wanted from this committee as well as from his other policy committees.
Now, was this Obama saying to you, I want to talk to scientists, can you round them up? Or, what drove this?
I think that Brock really understands how important science and technology are.
Now, I'm really curious about this because, when you read his books, for example, I'm thinking especially of the first book, The Dreams of My Father, and which gives a really clear sense of where he's coming from as an individual. A remarkable story, but not necessarily a lot of exposure to science in his earlier life, very much committed to community issues, public issues, and policy. And with Al Gore, for example, there's a very pro-science politician, and I think over a couple of decades, America had a chance to see how Al Gore became embedded in the scientific worldview. With Obama, it's a lot harder to understand how, because we've heard from him so many positive statements about science since then. Where is that coming from?
Well, I don't know. But I do know that Barack is an incredible listener and that he asks questions and soaks up other people's knowledge like a sponge and then uses that to refine and expand his own understanding and thinking. And he seeks out people who disagree with him, equally with people who agree. He wants to test his ideas against the strongest arguments that might be made against them. He may change his view because of what he hears, or he may keep his view but understand the other point of view much better and understand the limitations to his own view or the reasons why the view he has is the one he wants to continue to have. I think science is one of many areas that he wouldn't have been expected to embrace or to understand based on his earlier life. But he has this insatiable curiosity and drive to understand and use that understanding for policies, for public policy, to change the world and make it better. I think also the fact that the Obama campaign responded to every request to answer questions about science.
That's actually something I want to ask you about because, of course, last year there was a fairly well-publicized effort on behalf of some scientists in the U.S. to get the candidates to debate science. This is the Science Debate 08. Now, that debate never happened, but in September, the Obama campaign responded in writing to a set of questions from Science Debate 08 about various aspects of science policy. I'm curious if you can tell me anything about how those questions were actually answered. To what extent was Barack Obama involved in actually crafting those answers or determining, what the profile of his science policy would look like, when it was laid out? How did that process take place?
Well, first of all, he and his campaign were really committed to responding to all such questions from the scientific community. And the campaign responded not only to the Science Debate 2008, which is the first and a very important set of questions, but also the set of questions that Nature asked and that Physics Today asked and a number of other organizations asked. I think that an important part of Barack's view of how policy can be created is that it should be created from the bottom up. It should be done in an inclusive way. In the end, he and his key advisors are going to make the decision about what the policy is going to be, but he really reaches out and wants the information and proposals about these things to be brought forward from the bottom up. And so that's what this committee did.
I want to ask you about where the administration goes from here on in, but before we get to that, you know, there was one, a lot of the science debate or a lot of the science issues circled around issues like climate change and healthcare. But there was one time where space science kind of came to the fore. There was a moment about a year ago in the spring of 2008 where during one of his campaign statements, Barack Obama, I'm sorry I can't quote directly, but he essentially alluded that maybe money that went to manned space flight might be better spent on something like early childhood education. The opposition seized on that. And there was this kind of a little bit of back and forth over what that really implied in terms of where NASA would be in an Obama administration. By the summer, there was kind of some backtracking on that, and we kind of got a solid affirmation of NASA. But I'm wondering if you were involved at all in any of that kind of any backroom conversation about that, whether you ever spoke to now President Obama about NASA. I mean, given that you are a space scientist and some of your research has involved unmanned spacecraft, whether NASA ever came up in your conversations?
So what I would say is that no, it did not. And the ability to have conversations with Barack became very, very less possible compared with several years ago. So I did not have any conversation with him about this. I think that Barack does fully understand, the cost benefits, the efficiency benefits, and the real capabilities of robotic space science missions in all fields. I think he also understands that there does have to be a balanced space program, and he's been very careful to say that, and to say as well that as we go forward with exploration of space, both in terms of robotic missions and in terms of manned missions, that we have to, do it in a measured way, we have to do it in a way that advances both of these as quickly as possible, but does them in a way that is matches where we are, the challenges that we face in doing that. And so, as with many, many things, he's a very patient person and wants things to move forward in a way that makes sense, not just because, someone wants such a thing to happen quickly. And I think that's reflected in his space science policy.
So it sounds, despite the challenges that are ahead, and there are certainly challenges economically that the world faces, let alone the United States, it sounds like you're pretty optimistic about where things are going.
I'm tremendously optimistic, and it really is in very large part because of the new president we have. And, he said when he announced his appointment of John Holdren as science advisor and also Harold Varmus and Eric Lander, along with John, as leaders of the Presidential Council on Science and Technology, that he was returning science to its rightful place at the front. We have to say that the fact that he made these appointments as early as he did, the fact that in this stimulus and economic recovery legislation, he strongly supported funding for science, and believe me, we've had a very lean set of 3 or 4 years here. He made that happen, of course, along with Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Leader Harry Reid of the House and Senate. You know, I am very, very encouraged.
Well, and I'm glad you mentioned that that phrase, which came up in the inaugural address, "We will restore science to its rightful place." A lot of ways to interpret a phrase like that. When you were listening and you heard that line, how did you react? What did that mean to you?
Well, it meant to me at least two things. One is that science really does have a crucial role to play in increasing human understanding about the universe that we live in, in inspiring intellectual curiosity, and in terms of innovation, and producing really good-paying new jobs, and in addressing these, you know, challenges of the 21st century of energy, of climate change. So, you know, I took that to mean he understands that, and as he's displayed. I also took it to mean a rightful place in being listened to in the councils of government, having the advice of science and its integrity be assured, first of all, and then listened to. And I think that we've also seen evidence of that. So, hearing that phrase again was music to my ears.
So you had invested so much time in this election, and I can't let this go without asking you what it was like on election night, when Obama came out ahead.
It was really a moving for me. When the ticker or went across the screen, you know, Obama is the president-elect. It was really very moving for me and for all the people I was with. I happened to be at that time not in Grant Park in Chicago, where so many people who live in Chicago were, but I was working for my son, Michael Lamb, in Northern Virginia on the ground. And so we had really gotten no sleep for very, very little sleep or no sleep for many days. And so we gathered after everything was over, and listen to this. And I have to say, I was moved and at the same time sad. I was sad because this incredible journey, this part of this incredible journey had come to an end. And it had allowed me to do so many things that I really cared about doing, and meet so many wonderful people. It was tinged with a little sadness. And frankly, also, we were just totally exhausted. So I think that it was even sometime later when just, you know how these things happen out of the blue, that some little event makes you realize what's happened. And I probably felt more feelings about it even at some of those other moments than I could that night, because we were just so tired.
Wow, that's very powerful. Now, I guess, of course, though, it wasn't completely over for you, as tired as you might have been, because it wasn't long before you were part of the transition team.
Right, that's right. So, very quickly, the Brock and his advisors and the team wanted to do the transition in a way that was much quicker than had been typically done in the past, and certainly in the recent past. And so I was reached out to very, very quickly to join the transition team as part of a policy working group that had never been a part of a transition team before. And this policy group was called TIGR, the Technology, Innovation, and Government Reform Policy Working Group. There have been policy working groups in the past on education and labor, on national defense, and so on. There had never been a policy working group in a transition on technology and innovation and science. So I think that comes back to a question you had earlier. What's Obama think about science and technology? And he listened and said, yes, for the first time ever, we should have a policy working group that will include science, technology, and innovation as its charge.
Well, I just want to finish up by asking you, so the election is over, the outcome is what you had hoped for, clearly. The administration's underway. So what happens now with Donald Lamb? Do you hang up your campaigning hat and put back on your astrophysicist hat, or, you know, what's next?
So for Don Lamb, the future will be to help in any way I can to assure, insofar as we can, that the promise of this moment be fulfilled for science and more broadly. I did not want to move to Washington, D.C. I'm not planning to move to Washington, D.C. So I, you know, will do that from my home base here in Hyde Park. Brock and Michelle's and their family's home base, but they're now moved to D.C. I will stay here, but will help in any way I can, either through grassroots efforts, as, you know, that certainly can continue, or if I can help by offering advice, you know, I will be really, really glad to do that.
Well, Don Lamb, I've really enjoyed speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ivan. It's been really very much a wonderful opportunity to, you know, be able to share some of these things with you and with your listeners.
I spoke with Donald Lamb in Chicago. Since that interview was recorded, science and science-related policies have continued to enjoy a high profile in the Obama White House. Meanwhile, if you'd like to watch some simulations of white dwarf stars detonating, you can find a link to the Flash Center on our website, www.di.utoronto.ca/journalist. And that's it for this episode of The Universe in Mind. Remember, you can subscribe to our show on iTunes. The Universe in Mind is brought to you by the Dunlap Institute for Astronomy and Astrophysics at the University of Toronto. Kathy Parrott is our online producer. Thanks also to Hugh Zhao and Angela Choi. Our cover art is by Bettina Forget, with graphics by Efahan Elby. I'm Ivan Semenik. Be sure to check in with me next week for more news and conversations about the world of astronomy. And in the meantime, don't forget to keep the universe in mind. Thanks.